So it gives us. All right. Call to order the Transportation Committee meeting for the Coachella Valley Association of Governments for Monday, July 12th, 2021, 10 a.m. Roll call, please.
White. He's present. Cathedral City.
Here.
Coachella. Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Indian Wells.
Indian Wells is present.
Indio, La Quinta,
present.
Palm Desert,
here.
Palm Springs,
here.
Rancho Mirage,
here.
Riverside County,
here.
Agua Caliente, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. We'll move to public comments. Do we have any public comments on items on the agenda?
We have one raised hand. Just a moment, please.
Yes.
Yes, good morning. My name's Brad Anderson. I currently live in the city of Rancho Mirage, and I wanted to request, if it's okay with the council or the board, if I could possibly, if desired, give public testimony when the discussion item is presented to the board.
We have that now, so we only have two items on our agenda, Brad. It would be this time that you would do that, so could you please do it now?
Yes, I could. Item 5B is the one I'm concerned about, and as you know, that's a very detailed feedback, and I just wanted to get the rest of the counselors and the staff report prior to comments.
I'm not understanding why you want to wait to that item. So could you make your comments now?
I would like to, well, I wouldn't be as informed, so I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to at this time. So I will reserve the right for non-agenda public comments at that time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comments, Joanna?
I don't see any other raised hands.
So. All right. Thank you very much. We'll move on to item number four, which is a chair and executive director announcements. I don't have any announcements, Tom.
I don't either.
Move to item number five, discussion action items. Our first one is a presentation of CV Sink construction kickoff, and I'm going to give it to Mr. Kirk.
Mr. Chair, the city of Indio is present.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. This has been a long time coming. We're going to show a few slides, and then we're going to have a little fun with a light switch. And most of you know, and certainly the chair well knows, we've been at this talking about signal synchronization for a long, long time. Actually, we were talking about it 20 years ago at CVAG, and we did some initial work. And we know that we've done some signal synchronization in individual corridors and for individual cities at times, coordinating the entire Coachella Valley with federal dollars and involving Caltrans is a heck of a challenge. And our team has done a fantastic job of getting over a number of challenges. These are some of the images coming from a pilot project we did last year to demonstrate that it can work. The use of one controller across different conditions and different cities and working together as one region, as we do very well, can happen on our corridors. As you all know, most of our visitors don't really care when they cross a city boundary, they just want to get from point A to point B as quickly, efficiently, and safely as possible. And that's what this program is all about. In February of 2021, you recommended and the executive committee awarded a $21 million contract to Crosstown Electrical Data. And as you all know, we like to do groundbreakings and celebrate projects. Signal synchronization is more about technology than it is about construction. And so we figured out we do it a little bit differently, and actually kind of worked out in an era of a pandemic to do a virtual, and this made some sense in this case, a technology specific groundbreaking ceremony. And so Crosstown has started, they actually have gotten started last a month or two, but we wanted to celebrate your hard work, your political leadership, and the work of really dozens of interest agencies and individuals. Work will begin, in fact, has begun on Highway 111 As you know, the contract was for three corridors, Ramon, Washington, and Highway 111. Work is starting in the southeast of the Coachella Valley and Coachella and working towards the northwest. Traffic management centers will be going in this year. And next phase, and you'll hear more about this in the coming months, is a 21 additional corridor project where we get most of the major arterials in the Coachella Valley. So we're going to celebrate all of this hard work, and I'll say some nice things appropriately about our team and staff after we do so. And we'll do so by taking your light switch when I ask you to. Don't, no premature light switch. Oh, Mayor Holmes, no, not yet. What you're going to do, I know we're going to go from, in this case, we're going to go in reverse since Coachella and Indio get the first technology. We're going to start on the other end of the valley and move towards you. And we'll start with our chair. And when I say your name, you're going to bring it up and you're going to flip the switch better than I just did. And then we're going to take a screenshot of all of us and keep yours up. And we're going to wait till everybody's showing theirs. I do have to acknowledge Rancho Mirage is a little ahead of us on their own project, and we will be coordinating with them. And I know Mark Lancaster is sitting in for the county. So Mark, when the county comes up, I'll bring another light switch up for you, okay?
Perfect.
All right, let's give this a try. Chairman Mattis, Desert Hot Springs. Flip your switch. Excellent work. Palm Springs, Dennis Woods. Flip your switch. Excellent. Cathedral City, Raymond Gregory. Oh, nice work. Nice. Do not look into the light. Good work on that. Palm Desert, Jan Harnick. Flip your switch. Good work. Dana Reed, Indian Wells.
I feel awful. I never got a switch.
Oh. Oh no. Oh, no, don't I say that.
It probably went to Doug Hansen or Ty Peabody, but I didn't. I didn't get one.
Make sure they're not out there at your post box, because
I got the mail last Saturday and it wasn't there.
Did you send your chauffeur out to go look around for it in the neighborhood?
No, they took the week off.
That might explain it. They may not have allowed CVAG staff into the city to give this to you. I apologize for that.
No problem.
La Quinta, Robert Radai, your turn. Good work. Indio, Mayor Holmes. Oh, do not look into the light. Look what happened. She disappeared. Oh my God, he should not look into the light. They warned us. Our friends from Coachella are not here, Stephen Hernandez, but we'll flip a switch for him and Riverside County. I guess I'm gonna flip for Riverside County and Indian Wells for you both. Good work, everybody. Yay. Groundbreaking, virtual. Another CVAG first.
And Tom, before you go on, I just want to tell a quick little story. I've been on RCTC for almost 14 years now, and one of the first meetings I attended, I'm in the bus going to Riverside, and Dick Kelly's sitting in the bus with me, and one of the subjects came up on signal synchronization, and he said, until technology changes, nothing ever is going to take place, and this is not going to get done. But technology changed, and we finally made it over that hill, and I think we're moving towards something that's really positive. I think he'd be proud of all of us at this point. So he was a big proponent of transportation and moving traffic, so I think he'd be excited.
And Chairman Mattis, you're right about that. I do want to acknowledge Eric Cowell, who you've seen these presentations for a number of years, and explaining what all this means and how we're doing it, and Martin Magana, and of course, Jonathan Hoy. And AdventTech has been our design and engineering partner, Carlos Ortiz and his staff, and TKE is our construction manager. So a big round of applause to all of you and to the entire team. Thank you very much. And to proving Dick Kelly right eventually, right? So thank you.
Awesome. Any other comments, anyone? Okay, we'll move on from this item. We'll move to item B, which is regional bicycle and pedestrian guidelines. And I believe Eric is going to give the report on this.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members, and any attending staff. This was initiated back in September of 2019 when we were talking about the arts and music line and approving a contract to design that project. And there was a lot of discussion in the transportation committee about regional guidelines and perhaps the need to have some type of regional expectation. As you know, if you're traveling north and south in most of our cities, you're staying in one city, but the minute you go east and west, you're most likely traveling through multiple jurisdictions. And just an idea that when we design these regional arterial projects, that there be some type of expectation from the traveling public, especially the bicyclist and the pedestrian, that they see some type of, that they have some type of expectation of design standard as they go through the valley. So we added this to Webb and Associates contract, and now they're delivering their draft version of these guidelines. They've today we're joined by Webb's staff. Dilesh Sheth is the project manager, and we have Eric Lewis, who's done most of the work on this project. I'd just like to introduce Eric a little bit. He's been in the field for 30 years, not that field, but he's been in the transportation and active transportation field. He's also been the city engineer for the city of Fontana, traffic engineer for the city of Fontana, the city of Moreno Valley. So he really knows his traffic, not just his active transportation, but he's also an avid cyclist. And when I say that, he tells me that he's put 8,000 miles a year on his bicycle. And that's more miles in the last year than I put on my car, I believe. So it's pretty impressive. For this project, he's spent many days cycling throughout the Coachella Valley and making observations. So I'm going to turn it over to Eric and Dilesh, and they'll take you through the draft guidelines. We would ask that within 2 weeks, so maybe by the 26th, if you do have any comments or changes or issues that you'd like to raise with these guidelines, if you could submit them to me within 2 weeks, Eric Cowell, ecowell@cvag.org. I would appreciate that. And we will get these back to you in the fall in the form of a final draft and with recommendations on how we can implement them. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Eric Lewis.
So good morning, Chair Mattis, members of the Transportation Committee and CVAG staff and anybody participating out there in the audience. I'm excited to present the active transportation design guidelines for you today. And so a framework for the discussion is we're going to have a brief discussion on what active transportation actually is, its definition, and then look at some design guidance and specific examples. And then at the end, we'll entertain questions and answers and then discuss next steps. So what is active transportation? Active transportation is essentially traveling from point A to point B using human energy. So primarily accomplished using a bicycle or walking. I could also include other micromobility options such as skateboards and scooters. And active transportation has a lot of benefits. First and foremost, you reduce traffic congestion because people get out of their cars. You get community health benefits. You get air quality benefits. And then you get social benefits because it activates and transforms communities into vibrant destinations. So in developing these guidelines, we took some initial steps to determine the state of the practice in the region. So the first step was to discuss what design documents are used to make decisions for infrastructure. So I reached out to your public works staff, and overwhelmingly the answer was the California Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, otherwise known as the California METCD. And so the next step, as Eric mentioned, is I rode my bike across the valley, stopping at numerous locations. And it was roughly a map there that showed like 17 different locations, and it just a survey in each agency on what infrastructure is existing, roadway type and conditions, existing speed limits. And this was done on Palm Drive, Fred Waring, and Highway 111, seen as three main corridors that are important to cycling. And then thirdly, here are just some examples. And then also it provide the opportunity for pictures for local examples that are inclusive into the guidelines. And then the last step was we surveyed social media, specifically cycling pages on Facebook and Instagram, to get a sense of what it's like to cycle in the region and what their thought process was. And overwhelmingly, again, the two main items that came up were maintenance of the facilities themselves that are existing, and then route continuity. So these were the important factors that were voiced in that social media. So the purpose of the design guidelines is to supplement, not replace, design documents. As Eric mentioned, to achieve consistent application on multiple or multi-jurisdictional corridors. This will be woven into future funding reimbursement agreements in one form. And then it's also meant to augment general plan and or active transportation master plans that are in place. So the goals, first and foremost, of good infrastructure is improving safety for vulnerable users, which peds and bicycles fall into that category. To reduce single occupant vehicle trips, I should note that almost half of household trips are less than 3 miles in length, easily achieved by not using a vehicle and using some other means. We also want to employ best practices throughout the region for consistency. And then we want to improve equity amongst the transportation system users, complete streets applications. So in Portland, they developed a well-known study on different types of cyclists. And so they put them into various subsets to get a sense of how they would design their infrastructure. And so the first category, they're termed strong and fearless, and this represents less than 1% of the cyclists on the road. They'll ride basically anywhere under any conditions, weather, or infrastructure. The next, we have the enthused and confident, and they're comfortable riding in most infrastructure, although they would prefer lower speed streets, and they also gravitate towards multi-use paths when available. And the largest subset of this group is the interested but concerned, and representing about 60% of the cyclists out there. And they are looking for low speed streets, and they're concerned about their safety, obviously. This has the greatest opportunity to get mode shift if you design for this category here. And then the last is the no way, no how. This group feels that riding in traffic with a bicycle is unsafe, and pretty much you can't convince them to ride a bicycle anywhere. So facility selection, this provides the opportunity to look at roadway conditions, specifically traffic volume, speed, number of lanes, right-of-way available, et cetera. And instead of designing with the minimum requirements in mind, we want to use a contextual solution for the type of roadway that's there. And this also spurs discussion amongst the agencies as to agree to what the best facility is and have consistency along the corridor. It also promotes greater separation as speeds go up. So we want to improve that separation as the speeds go up. And then it's an opportunity to take a regional viewpoint of local projects. So look at it, how it fits in the regional system. So when looking at different corridors, oftentimes there's limited pavement available to develop the facility that you would like. And so one tool that's often employed is what's termed a road diet. And so on the left-hand side, you'll see a typical 64-foot arterial, four lanes, no bike facilities. And maybe that roadway doesn't need to have four lanes based on current or existing traffic conditions. So you can repurpose that lane into an active transportation facility such as bike lanes, or oftentimes combined with parking. And road diets have the benefit of improving traffic safety, reducing traffic speeds, which is always a concern, and providing more uniform traffic flow. So there's a variety of bicycle infrastructure, and this goes in great detail in the document. But the first category is a class three marked shared roadway. This is put down with the SHAROs, what's it called, SHAROs, so there's shared lane markings, and often augmented with bikes may use full lane. This is on lower speed streets where bicycles and vehicles share the same space. And these can be applied in residential neighborhoods with a variety of traffic calming features to try to get the speed of the vehicles and the bicycles as close together. And that's termed a bicycle boulevard. They're used as parallel routes to major arterials to provide connections without the cyclist having to go out onto the major arterial. So the next category is the traditional class two bike lane, where space exclusive for bicyclists is striped on the roadway. We've all seen those bike lanes, and they can be further augmented with buffering to help meet the California 3-foot for Safety Act requirements, as well as green markings in the conflict areas to bring awareness to motorists of the presence of bicyclists. Next category is separated bikeways, also known as cycle tracks or class four facilities. And these areas are separated by different forms. Could be plastic posts with striping, could be raised barriers or a raised barrier with parked vehicles. And then the last category is a class one shared use path that most people are familiar with. These are the most highly desirable cycling facilities, but they often take years to develop and to construct. And so once they are in place, they're heavily used. And folks like to ride to these facilities, so it's important to look at connectors from various neighborhoods and other destinations. So somebody wants to get off and go to a commercial site to eat lunch or leave from their community to actually reach the destination. Connectors are important and they're easier to implement. So as we talk about infrastructure, we also want to focus on intersections because the majority of the crashes that occur for cyclists are at intersections. So one treatment is called a bend out, and this is based on federal guidance, and this has been used in the European countries, but it effectively pushes the bike path or bikeway away from the roadway, and it allows the vehicle time to turn the corner a little slower and to see and improve the visibility of the cyclists, as well as reduce the speed of the vehicles crossing the path. And the next one is a what's called a protected intersection, and it's intended to reduce conflicts between pedestrians, vehicles, and cyclists. And this basically reduces crossing distances. It also greatly improves the visibility of the cyclists when they're crossing. And then it also reduces the turning speeds around the corners. And they're protected intersections are just basically a series of bend outs as shown on the earlier slide. So two-stage left turns, oftentimes it can be perilous for cyclists to cross a multi-lane arterial to turn left. So the agency can install these green two-stage boxes where the cyclist pulls into the box and then waits to execute the second half of their turn when they are given a corresponding green for the other movement. So two-stage left turns. And then we have bicycle bypass lanes at T intersections. This allows the cyclists to move independently of motor vehicles at certain movements for traffic signals, and it reduces stopping and starting for bicyclists, which greatly benefits them because their momentum is maintained. So there's just a couple examples. And getting into the pedestrian-specific facilities, we have a median refuge. This is essentially the crosswalk goes through a raised median. This reduces the exposure for the pedestrians, so they're of the vehicles, and gives them an opportunity to pause and check traffic as they execute their movements. Curb extensions. This effectively pushes the pedestrian waiting area into the intersection. It greatly improves the visibility of the pedestrians as they're standing on the corner. It reduces their crossing distances and reduces speeds through the intersection. It also affords an opportunity to buffer parking lanes. And you'll see this example there on the right in downtown Palm Springs. So an offset crosswalk, this is essentially a two-stage crossing where pedestrian monitors one direction of traffic and then can pause in the median with raised surface around them. And then before they execute their next crossing maneuver, by design, the pedestrian observes the traffic approaching them so they can make their decision as to when and what time to cross. We also have raised crosswalks. So the crosswalk itself is at the same level as the surrounding sidewalk. And then the vehicles must come up to that level with a slight undulation. And this slows vehicle speeds going across the crosswalk. In addition, it brings awareness of the crossing because there's more markings and speed differential features. So as all agencies have numerous traffic signals, it's important to provide for bicyclists and pedestrians and provide adequate timing for them to get across the street. And there's ways of detecting bicycles, push buttons and video and radar. It's important though that they be given enough time to get across the street. And modern traffic signals are able to detect when a bicyclist is actually present. So they don't provide this timing unnecessarily because it can reduce efficiency. And it's my understanding that the CV Sync project that was mentioned or discussed earlier will have this feature throughout the region. So bringing it into modern capabilities. Innovative pedestrian, here is what's termed an all-way walk or all-way crosswalk with or pedestrian scramble. And so in areas where large pedestrians are encountered, all vehicles are stopped and then pedestrians can move in all directions, including diagonally. These are traditionally in a downtown environment. It's my understanding that Palm Springs has a couple of these designs and are waiting to implement them at some near-term date. So there's in the document, there's discussion about roundabouts. Roundabouts are one of my favorite tools for improving traffic safety. They greatly reduce conflict points and they make crossing an intersection easier for pedestrians because they only have to monitor one direction of traffic at a time. Bicyclists will typically share the lane with vehicles and traverse through the roundabout. Or if they're not comfortable doing that, they can take a bypass lane and go to the outside or the outside of the roundabout, like this example shown in La Quinta. Also, cyclists encounter railroad and transit, and so it's important that bike paths cross rail crossings at a 90-degree angle. Fortunately, there's not too many of these in existence because most of them are grade separated, but there are a few, I think, in the eastern part of the valley. And then transit, buses are constantly coming to traffic, to bus stops in and out. And so bringing awareness of bicycle traffic next to them improves safety. So there's discussion there. So oftentimes in design guidelines, one factor that's overlooked is maintenance. And so it's important for agencies not only to install quality infrastructure, but develop plans to maintain it well. I like to say that if you build it, they will come, but if you don't maintain it, they won't come back. And so here is on the left, you'll see a street sweeper that's specific to separated facilities. It's a little smaller. The next slide is just an example of a bike path that the pavement has been pushed up due to tree roots, and this can create a very undesirable condition for cyclists. And then the third picture, the bane of cycling is goat heads, as they're called, and they're produced by puncture vine. And so methods of eradicating those near bike facilities is greatly enhances the cycling experience because you reduce flats. And then you want to keep your bikeways clear of roadway debris and landscaping. So these are just some samples of things that you see out there. Next, construction. So fortunately, there's a lot of construction going on, and cyclists and pedestrians need to be accommodated with route continuity through the work zones, or given alternatives. They're often, again, overlooked. And then the sites need to be reviewed for defects that could be a hazard to cyclists. This particular one on the right, where two construction plates were installed improperly, creating a gap, and bicycle could get their wheel trapped and cause a crash, and or a multitude of cyclists because they often ride in groups. So these are important factors. Next is tort liability. Good infrastructure and maintenance helps to reduce exposure to tort cases. All agencies are going to get sued anyway, but having a good plan and good defense is the best way to handle those kind of cases. Here's some samples of roadway defects. Here's some landscaping that's blocking the sidewalk, pothole in a crosswalk, an uneven sidewalk, which we see a lot due to tree roots. And then lastly, an unfriendly bicycle grate that could trap a wheel and force a crash. Majority of the cases that I've seen in my career for roadway defects of these types range anywhere from $2 to $10 million. And I saw one as high as $49 million for cycling. And so that's a lot of money that was given in the form of judgments that maybe shouldn't have happened. So bicycle amenities, good good infrastructure also includes bicycle amenities. This would be short-term, long-term parking at key destinations. Parking should be visible so people feel safe about locking up their bike. And then on the right, this is a bicycle corral. And for the same space as one vehicle, you can accommodate up to 8 bicycles. And a lot of times these are put in areas of high commercial use and folks want to ride and get something to eat or go to another destination. And so it's just an efficient way of parking bicycles on the street. Next amenity is wayfinding signs and water bottle filling stations. And so knowing where you are on the route, as well as key destinations that are within riding distance is important. Here you can see, again, the trailhead for the completed segment of the CV link. It has a nice version of the wayfinding sign. Then you can see the water bottle filling station and also some benches and short-term parking. So the last aspect I want to discuss is a bicycle-friendly community. So bicycle-friendly communities have the same benefits as active transportation, which would include, you know, improving public health, air quality, quality of life for the residents, and reducing traffic congestion. To be designated as a bicycle-friendly community, it's a self-application process through the League of American Bicycles. And the focus is on the 5 E's, which includes engineering, education, encouragement, enforcement, and evaluation and planning. And you make this application, and the designations can be anywhere from a bronze level up to a diamond, depending on how well the agency accommodates cyclists and the various programs that they put forth. So this is an opportunity to enhance your community with this designation, and it also improves tourism and folks gravitate towards bicycle-friendly communities. And in addition, good infrastructure improves home values adjacent to those facilities. So, and with that concludes the presentation, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
So thank you, Eric. And I'd like to just throw in one perhaps way of kind of reframing this, if it helps, is to think about how successful the region has been in getting highway safety improvement grants, ATP grants. We've been very successful. We've been very good at kind of retrofitting the arterials, our regional arterials, with these types of improvements. And I think the idea of having regional guidelines is to perhaps design them in the first place with these type of best practices and these type of guidelines, so that from day one, the arterial, as we widen it, it already has all of these components for pedestrians and bicycles. So that's just a different way of looking at it, is designing our corridors so that they don't need ATP grants in 5 years. Anyway, I'll leave that open for questions for Eric.
Thank you, Eric. I brought this question to Tom and his staff a couple years ago. Do we have guidelines? As we were moving forth with a lot of these ATP grants, I asked a question, you know, instead of reinventing the wheel, do we kind of look at having the similar guidelines throughout the Coachella Valley? As a bicyclist group here in Desert Hot Springs came to me about 4 years ago and really praised Palm Springs on their progressive movement on making sure that there was a lot of bike routes there, and they would literally ride from Desert Hot Springs to Palm Springs. They felt safer. So it really brought forth a question in my head to our staff, is what are we doing to make sure that our bicyclists are safety, have a lot of safety measures put into place when we do our road projects here at Desert Hot Springs. So I'm not trying to bring this forward to take away our local control in our own cities. What I'm just asking is, if we do design something in our local cities and we want some guidelines and see where the state goes and what Caltrans is coming up with, maybe it's an opportunity as a committee to be able to look at these and be similar. As mentioned in the presentation, there's no real boundaries when it comes to a bicyclist. They know they're leaving La Quinta and they know they're going to go to Palm Springs, but do they care when they get through Palm Desert, Ranch Mirage, or any other city at that point? They're just going from point A to point B. And so having the same guidelines maybe and road markers and those types of things are important. I also wanted to mention I was working late one night driving through Palm Desert, and the CV Link construction going in Palm Desert was just fantastic. And why I mentioned the nighttime was they came up with these solar lights that flash blue and I believe orange if it's a different direction. But I happened to catch these blue flashing lights along COD as it turned on to Magnesia Falls, and it was just it was wonderful to see that, because it literally marked out as a driver on the road that was a safety zone for the bicyclists that might have been out during the evening. And there are bicyclists that like to ride during the evenings. So I was really impressed with what Palm Desert is doing with theirs portion of the CV Link, and crossing our fingers. The budget gets approved soon, but we're in the budget right now for $29 million up to Desert Hot Springs to extend the CV Link into our city, and $16 million for the art and music line in the East Valley. So with those types of standards, I know CV Link has standards right now, but does the rest of our connectors have standards are the question. So again, just a conversation and a great report by Webb and by CVAG staff. So thank you. I'll open up the questions now from the committee. I see Palm Springs. You're still muted, Dennis.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say that Palm Springs applauds the move to take to standardize this. I think, as the chairman said, moving from one city to the next and making that as seamless as possible, I think is important. I just want to add a few comments, which we'll send off to Eric. We'll send it to you as well. One, I think, bike boxes during for locations such as schools and major employment centers might be something we want to depict in there, especially if you want to go up for funding for bike boxes, bike lockers. You can call them either way. I don't know. I don't think the standards actually include things like providing closed lockers and showers in industrial areas. Yeah, I know this is standards, but some mention of providing that so that people might be more inclined to bike and walk. But I do think, however, that what we probably want to do is buff up the pedestrian part of this. It's very heavy on bicycling. And I just want to give you an example. So Dinah Shore in the city of Cathedral City installed a couple of hawk crosswalks. The city of Palm Springs is going to be doing the same. And I think this should be part of Chapter 7 for pedestrian and infrastructure. And then bicycle operating spaces on page 17, there should be a similar diagram for pedestrians to encourage people to walk side by side with room for an approaching person to walk past them. We might also want to include a shy distance of 2 feet from walls and hedges on the property line when sidewalks are next to the property line. And we probably want to encourage the use of trees, shade trees for pedestrian sidewalks. I've done this in other jurisdictions that I've worked at, and it can provide a great opportunity and a respite for people in the intense desert heat for that. And then another issue just with bicycling is, there's confusion about what to do with electric bikes, especially on the public street. Do they go into the travel lane? Do they use the bike lanes? And just having some verbiage about electric bikes in this whole discussion might be beneficial. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Cathedral City.
Thank you. And more of a comment, I guess, than a question, although I'll end with a question. So as someone who definitely is in the interested but concerned category, I really thought this was a great report and really laid out better and more succinctly than anything I've seen before as far as what some of the issues are, especially with cyclists, but also pedestrians. So I just want to make sure that I add in that we certainly do support this, and thank staff and this committee for everything that you've done towards moving towards this. I'm a big supporter of looking for separated bikeways and shared use paths where we can. And I think what I've seen in the past is sometimes we get these projects going A lot is looked at, well, what can we do with the existing roadway and the existing right-of-way, which sometimes that is the way or the main consideration. It is the factor that's going to be the decision maker, but I do think that it's important that we look at all of these different possibilities. So I'll end with, how do we see the process going when we have a project and it is brought to CBAG for some type of funding or submission as part of the ATP? Is this then guideline going to be discussed with the public works staff and others that are bringing it forward? And what types of considerations are going to be evaluated as far as existing roadway, right-of-way costs, those types of things?
Tom, Eric, did you want to try to?
Well, I can answer the question. Generally, the idea would be on project inception, I would create sort of a mini alignment study, if you will, just a kind of a 30% plan, and it'll identify all the right-of-way opportunities or constraints and all the players or all the jurisdictions that are part of the project would get together and agree upon some facility. And that was part of the discussion, was the facility selection, and then come to conclusion on what's the most desirable facility for all jurisdictions for not only safety, but continuity. And then look at opportunities for funding and see what it's gonna cost. So, you know, not immediately discount one particular facility due to cost or right away, just see what's desirable first, and then look to the avenue of how you can actually build it, whether it be grant money or CVAG money or some other sources. So.
All right, I appreciate that. I know you started off by saying that this isn't meant to be the final where we're dictating that a certain type of facility is the way to go. It sounded like this was more of a discussion and hopefully come to a consensus. Is that what you're looking for?
I believe that to implement this, you know, instead of just approving a set of guidelines and putting it on the shelf, I think that, again, without having to add to costs or add to time delay on a project, I think it's just as simple as perhaps a checklist at one or two points in the design process when we hand a project off to our design engineers, just to ensure that they're considering, again, these guidelines aren't meant to be prescriptive. They're just meant to be illustrative of what we could do, what we can do. And I suspect it would be some type of a checklist that we go through just to ensure that we're considering what amenities can be provided for the cyclist and pedestrian. We tend to design our regional arterials for the vehicle and then just kind of defer to the minimum striped bicycle lane for the cyclists instead of thinking, perhaps like we did on Arts and Music Line and others, what can we do for the cyclists and for the pedestrians above and beyond the minimum striping a 5-foot lane for them? And I think it's just as simple as perhaps consideration in the design process, and we could build that into our reimbursement agreements. There's a lot of ways we could just say, hey, at this point of pre-design or at this point in design, Just sit down with the affected communities and the design engineers and perhaps just go through a checklist that, hey, we're considering these things.
All right, excellent. Sounds like an excellent first step. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bob Desert?
Thank you, Chair. A couple of things. First of all, thank you for all the work on this. This is great, and it's exciting to see this come together. And I know in Palm Desert, we've gotten great reaction to the spur off the CV link and all the work that's been done. And, you know, the San Pablo and the complete streets on San Pablo has been a great asset. The other thing I just wanted to comment, first of all, Dennis Woods, his comment about shade trees, anytime we can throw in some native or at least water-wise canopy trees, the benefits are myriad. I mean, there's just so much in so many ways that we benefit by that. And it's something we should be all considering in our cities and certainly along any bike routes. The other thing, I wanted to mention the raised crosswalks that we brought up, and many of you may know, we put those on El Paseo, a couple of them, and a couple of them on the streets that run perpendicular to El Paseo. They have been tremendously successful. It slows traffic down. It allows for bicyclists and autos to share the lane because of the speed reduction. And they have really served. And, you know, it keeps people from who were going to cross the street anyway. We created a situation where they are no longer jaywalking. They're walking in a crosswalk that we've provided for them. So the raised crosswalks are tremendously successful and have been helpful to everybody. They really create a safe environment for active transportation. And thank you for the 2 weeks for comments. I'm sure you'll get a lot. And this is exciting that we're looking at these guidelines and we're looking at it region-wide. Thank you.
Nikita.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One aspect that I would like to reiterate is what Mr. Cole just said regarding this not being prescriptive, but being guidelines. And I think it's important because there's a level of context that has to be kept into consideration for each jurisdiction. Having said that, though, this is a fantastic presentation. I'm so pleased with the report. I thought that the use of the logical flow, the way it was constructed, the use of graphics and recommendation was really very well done. Excellent work. However, it comes down to, this is really what CIVAG is at best, right? We see that it is the center of knowledge that can help all individual jurisdictions. So this is really something that we should all adopt at the city level in various jurisdictions. One thing that I think that we have to keep in consideration is a living document. We talk about best practices, but remember that that's in the simple domain. We are in complexity, and so we should always look at what is emerging. So we should really keep track of what is emerging in alternative transit. One aspect that I'd like to make a recommendation now is that throughout the presentation, I didn't see anything connected to bus stops. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Those bus shelters are there. Many people that bike, they do use a bus to go from point A to point B. And then this is really important for public transit when it comes down to first mile, last mile, that people will use alternative transportation. They load the bike on the front of the bus, off they go. But once they are there, what can we do as cities to facilitate the transit of these individuals on the road? And so that probably some guideline what to do around bus shelters to facilitate those that use the bus to go from long distance and then they use the bicycle for shorter distance would be very useful. Other than that, those are all my comments. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. I see Bob Desert back in.
I just had a quick other thing. So many of us have dining decks. And if all the government agencies align and we are allowed to keep them and make them even nicer, keep in mind that those dining decks have created very natural bike parking areas right next to them in the street. They're safe and it creates a great place to put bikes. And even this is one of those times you can say, it happened organically. So just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much. I don't have any other hands raised. Anybody else in the committee? Yes, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, for an opportunity. Just a quick comment. And I know this goes pretty much without saying because all of our public works projects have to be ADA compliant. But another vulnerable entity out there are people in wheelchairs. So I just want to ask the Eric and Delesh to keep that in mind, even if it's just saying that all these facilities also need to be ADA compliant. It is a part of the whole mix of folks that are out there that I think needs to be considered. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, I really appreciate the report today. Fantastic presentation. And moving forward, again, the comment period will be open for a while, and we'll come back with a final presentation sometime in the fall. Tom, did you need to add anything? Great. We'll move to information, item number six. And that's for information. Item number seven is public comments on non-agenda items. Joanna, do we have any?
We do have Robert Manning. He's been moved in. Bob?
Mr. Manning, you just need to unmute yourself. There you go, Bob.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, thank you. Sorry I couldn't come in on the front end of the meeting. However, there's something I would like to bring to your attention, and that is that the Palm Springs train station has been closed for approximately the last 2 months due to too much sand, and apparently the UP is refusing to open it, open the train station. I know we're trying to get a daily sunset train in here, and we're trying to make the Sunset Limited a daily train. And along with that, we're trying to get a regular daily train from Los Angeles to service the valley, and the only station available is the Palm Springs station at this point. Also, there's an issue with sand buildup presently, and hopefully the city of Palm Springs can address that, which they have in the past. But again, unfortunately, something is going to have to be done as far as reaching out to both Amtrak and Union Pacific to restart service out here. This is really causing issues. And I just wanted to bring this to everyone's attention, especially the city of Palm Springs. And I would be happy to help in terms of personnel contact or what have you. But again, this is an issue that's going to have to be addressed.
Thank you, Bob. So, anything else?
That'll do it.
All right. Thank you for your time today. Do we have any other public speakers?
We have Brad Anderson with his hand raised.
Brad?
Hi, yes, Brad Anderson, City Ranch Mirage. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. I'm just going to read my notes here. I've been jotting stuff down. My note says, not allowed, the same consideration by the DHS chair, meaning Desert Hot Springs. And the reason I wrote that is because public comment, I asked for very little to listen to the staff. Well, I called a staff report, and that was refused. And I was, why would you refuse that opportunity to hear information that was not in the original written staff report unless you wanted to limit the public participation? And that's, this organization has done that to the extreme of this public comment and reducing non-agenda public comments, too. And it's well known. So anyway, I'll just keep voicing that. And if I go to Sacramento to do it, I will. But I just wanted to talk on curb extensions and bump outs, I guess you call them. And if that's a bump out on Pedro's Path in Palm Desert, I can assure you that people will be harmed, if not killed, by those. Being an avid biker myself and traveled all over the world, I would say that's a hazard, and it should be eliminated. And again, best practices would be allow people with public participation into these meetings, and unless you really, really don't want to hear from us, which you apparently are achieving. So thank you. Bye.
Thank you for your comments. Any other public comments, Joanna?
I see no other raised hands. Nope.
Any comments from the board committee members? All right. With that said, we'll move to item number 8, which is announcements, upcoming meetings. The next transportation meeting is scheduled for August 30th at 10 a.m. Due to the Labor Day holiday in September. And that, so we're gonna be back in person, Mr. Kirk. Is that what you're planning on?
We are actually serving all of you to ask how you wanna proceed. Meetings like this during the summer aren't so bad, are they? Some of us may wanna be getting out of town, and we may try to do this for a long time in the summer and still try to get together periodically or often the rest of the year. So it might be a mix, and we're looking for everybody's feedback and certainly coordinate with each one of our chairs.
Great. And then the executive meeting will be September 27th. With no other business in front of us, have a great day. We are adjourned.